To be honest, I'm really continuing part of what I started teaching last week. To review from last week, I was looking at the passage in regard to the high priest, and he was told you're only allowed to come in to the Holy of Holies. In regard to judgment, to put off judgment, to bring atonement once a year, and you had to bring this huge bull that he would have to slaughter for himself. That would have to be done first. And then this ram. And we looked at the size of the two, and that ram was for the whole family of Israel. The bull was for his family. And we compared it to Yeshua's parable, where he was teaching about the log that could be in our eye and a speck in our brother's. And that if we want to be able to help our brother, first and foremost, we had to go into ourselves and anything that was hindering how we were seeing him. Because we're really good at seeing problems in other people. But we are the blindest at seeing the problems in ourselves. And so we had to start in ourselves, and then maybe we could come and help others come closer. And that really leads us to today. So help wanted. And again, this goes out to everybody. Yahweh wants a person to serve in the Father's house 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Now, I expect some to go, wait a minute, what about Sabbath? What am I doing today? I'm still serving today. As we grow in our ministry, at some point you will start to realize that even your work that you do in the world is not work anymore. That doesn't mean we should be doing it on Sabbath to get paid, but if we're doing it for the right reasons, we go there not because to get a paycheck, we go there to minister. And so when I made the point of serving 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, service goes on, and I would expect all of us in this room know that Yahweh has an agenda, a calendar, and he has appointments. Sometimes he shares them with us ahead of time. But there are some times where they just pop up. And his timing is incredible. I don't know about you, for me, it's always those times where I'm sort of starting to get annoyed because something's going on that's slowing my schedule down. I'm in Walmart, and I'm looking at tents. And a woman comes over and starts talking to me, and she says, "I see your kippah." And her husband was Jewish. And this is a perfect stranger. About 15 minutes later, I got out of that conversation to be able to go on with what I was doing. But in that conversation, she was talking about her husband and how he was tied to Jerusalem and its importance. And for her, which didn't have her husband around, she needed someone just to talk to, that she could relate with, because of course there just aren't going to be many Jewish people we're going to run into in the Orange City Walmart. Well, because of that event, you then get to I get 15 minutes late getting to the cash register. And when I get there, I go, oh man, and I'm in a line, I forgot something. Collect all my stuff, I go back, put it back, get the thing I've got. Well, now the line I was in. So I come to another line. And I come to the line, and the lady goes, Is there one of those Jewish congregations around here? Yes. Do they accept all kinds of people? Yes. How close? Just a few miles down the road from here. Do you have a card? I happen to have a card because it's right where the credit card is in which I'm pulling out. My point in telling that story is not to say that I'm any different than any of you. It's to drive home the point that he has appointments made for us that we don't have on our agenda. And sometimes our agenda gets frustrated to make his agenda happen. Now, there's no set vacation time, because you can attend to the Father and his extensive family in other locations around the world. You think going somewhere else is going to mean, oh, I don't have to worry about ministry or about his Torah or about what I'm doing. You'll be surprised who you will run into in those places far away from your congregational home. He would love the person to have a joyful dispensation in all situations. Be long-suffering, kind. Not be jealous, rude, proud, self-seeking. Be humble. Sound familiar, by the way? Rejoicing in the truth, not in wrongdoing. Thinks no evil. Oh, that's a hard one. Bears all things, believes all things, that's another hard one, hopes all things, endures all things, that's probably one of the hardest, and one, of course, that's impossible, never fails. That's what he would like. Great medical plan. Benefits, incredible. Plan for life after service taken care of by the Father. No worry about what's going to happen after you've served him. All taken care of. Willing to take anyone up with an open heart, willing to be taught, and make changes in his or her life. You're like, well, where are you going with this? My point is that Yahweh's looking for people to serve in his house. So what does that mean? Turn with me to Exodus chapter 19. We were just there. But I don't know that there's enough times where we can read this verse. This verse speaks about the reality of how Yahweh sees us and what Yahweh wants us to attain to. Exodus 19, verses 5 and 6. This is after Yahweh goes, I've done this. I have gone and saved you. I have redeemed you. I have brought you out of the house of bondage. And then it leads into, now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant. Notice there's a clause here. Or you might say it's dependent upon. Then you will be a special treasure to me above all people. For the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests. Now that word there can mean an actual kingdom of priests, but it also can mean you could be king and priests. Al-Melchizedek, or Melchizedek, a holy nation. These are the words you shall speak to the children of Israel. So it's dependent on, if you will obey, then you can be priests. We're expected to be priests to the nations? What lessons can we learn from the priesthood? A lot of times we go through Leviticus and going, they're killing another animal. Here comes some more blood. I get on the altar, and the details can seem mundane. They can feel like we're going through it again. And in fact, we can make the mistake of going, I'm just going to skim this chapter. I can read quickly through it because I don't have to do any of it. But a lot of the commands are for the priests. And if he expects us to be priests, then there may be lessons in there for us to learn, broad and specific. Numbers chapter 8, verse 11. And Aaron shall offer the Levites before Yahweh, like a wave offering from the children of Israel, that they may perform the work of Yahweh. Notice the focus. The work of Yahweh. That means as a priesthood, we're almost like a living sacrifice. I can't imagine what that would look like. You know, you take someone and you're going to wave them back and forth as a wave offering. You know, what are we doing here? But again, this point of a living sacrifice, that the people would have saw the priests wave back and forth all of these other offerings and then see the Levites being waved and the connection between them. Numbers chapter 1, if you go with me. Verses 47 to 53. Starting in verse 47. The Levites were not numbered among them by the father's tribe, for Yahweh had spoken to Moses, saying, "Only the tribe of Levi you shall number, nor take a census of them among the children of Israel. But you shall appoint the Levites over the tabernacle of the testimony, over all its first furnishings, and over all the things that belong to it. They shall carry the tabernacle and all its furnishings. They shall attend to it. They shall camp around the tabernacle. And when the tabernacle is to go forward, the Levites shall take it down. And when the tabernacle is to be set up, the Levites shall set it up. The outsider who comes near shall be put to death. The children of Israel shall pitch their tents, everyone by his own camp, everyone by his own standard, according to the armies. But the Levites shall camp around the tabernacle of testimony, that there may be no wrath on the congregation of the children of Israel, and the Levites shall keep charge of the tabernacle of the testimony." Now, there's a lot in there, a lot of responsibilities. First of all, we are responsible over the tabernacle of the testimony. Now, the testimony, you're like, that's an awfully big word. The testimony is a fancy word for basically saying the tablets, the commandments. The testimony had to be put in the ark. It was a testament that Yahweh had spoken to them. Now, what's intriguing here is that the first set of commands were broken. These were inscribed by the hand of God. Broken, destroyed. Yahweh told Moses, "You're going to go and you're going to break off a rock." He didn't have him do this the first time. "You're going to carry those rocks up to the top mountain. And the second time he spoke to him, you're going to engrave them." What's intriguing here is the very testimony we're supposed to be responsible over is actually the reality of obedience of Moses, because the words were written by him at this point, not by the finger of God. We have it only because of obedience of Moses. But we're responsible for that. Responsible for his commands. Responsible for his word. Responsible for the articles of the tabernacle. Whether it is the menorah, whether it is the table of the showbread, whether it is the laver where you'd have the water, where the hands and the feet had to be washed for you to go any further into the tabernacle, whether it was the altar. And that was not a clean responsibility. It was dirty, bloody. It was a mess. Need to carry the tabernacle and its articles. They had to bear it. Could not just specifically, some parts could go on carts, but even the carts they had to watch over. But the major parts had to be carried, specifically his word. Specifically his word. They had to attend to the tabernacle, and very importantly, they had to camp around it so there'd be no wrath on Israel. Now notice that it's connected to camping around it, that there'd be no wrath, judgment on Israel. By who? Yahweh. Keep charge of the tabernacle of the testimony. You got to keep watching over it. It wasn't like, "Oh, I checked it. It's good." It's sort of like a parent going, "Have you seen our child lately? Yeah, he's Yeah, he's out in the shed. He's got a saw. Yeah, no big deal. Like you saw him. No keeping. It's like, oh yeah, I'm going to go out and watch him. No big deal. It's fine. I'm going to go watch him. All right? To keep him. It's a continuing process. Now, to get an idea, this is basically how the camp would be set up. Here is our tabernacle, starting with the outer walls and all the different pieces going in. But around, you'd first have the priesthood, Aaron, Moses, and the priesthood that would be camping. The Levites would be the tents that would then surround the other three sides. And then you would have the tents specifically of the different tribes. Each side would have three different tribes, but even of the three tribes, you would have a chief man in each one, and each tribe had a chief man, so they would all follow that chief man, that one who was in charge. But the focus here is that here's Yahweh's tent. He set up the priests, he set up the Levites as close to him as possible. They're the ones that are going to be serving him daily. And then you have the people. Now, another diagram of this is you have your tabernacle. It's sort of different. You'd have to think, we were looking at the picture from this side. You have Moses and Aaron, the priesthood. You have the three different families of Levites, again, surrounding it. And then you have the three different tribes. Now, many people have tried to teach that when they would set up, that actually this was a picture of the cross. In fact, if you go on looking for images, some of the images will try and make a point that this looked like a cross. I'm going to tell you right now, it was not in the shape of a cross. Just from a defense strategy, you're allowing people to come in into the heart of your camp from four different directions. It would be more like that, where basically you would have had a wall of people all the way around to try and come in. You would have had to defeat large numbers of tribes to even get close. Again, that's that thought of, we'll take a New Testament concept and we're going to put it on an Old Testament picture. Not going to be the case. But again, the point here is the Levites are being commanded to be around Yahweh, around the tabernacle, so that he does not come out and have wrath or judgment on the Israelites. Now, Leviticus 26, verse 3, 11, and 12. Now, starting with verse 3. If you walk in my statutes and keep my commandments and perform them, that's verse 3. Now, all the other verses are after that. But it's an if-then statement. Then I will set my tabernacle among you, and my soul shall not abhor you. I love that. And I will be with you, and I won't hate you. And I will walk among you and be your God, and you shall be my people. Now, for him to tabernacle with us, it is dependent on us what? Walking in his statutes and keeping his commandments and performing them. Again, keep, hold, perform, continue to do. If we obey, then Yahweh will be with us, walk with us, and be our Elohim, and we his people. That's a pretty incredible benefit of following the commands. So, breaking it down, obedience equals a place for Yahweh. If there is no obedience, and I'll give it to another example. Yahweh is either for you or against you. And then he sort of has a third group that's like, wait and see. But when you make a decision, he's either for you or against you. And when your decision on a daily basis is, I'm not going to follow, well, you can just already figure out which side he's on. When you choose to follow, well, guess what? Doesn't matter how big the opponent is, Goliath or not, the one who's behind you is far taller, stronger, and greater. Because he's with you. But realize, if he's not with you, then he's against you. But it takes obedience to create the place. The priest shall sprinkle the blood all around the altar. I've really condensed all these things down. I was trying to go through all of Leviticus and all of Numbers to go through all the things. I could spend the rest of the day going through. And then I said, I'll just count them. And I was somewhere around 50 or 55, sitting there going, you know what? I don't have enough time to count all the things the priests had to do from Leviticus through Numbers that they were commanded to do on a daily basis. Over, and many of the commands were, and kill a lamb in the morning and the evening, perpetually. And sprinkle the blood, and sprinkle the blood, and sprinkle the blood. Place the sacrifices and the fire upon the altar. They not only had to take the sacrifices from the people and bring them, put them on the altar the way they needed to be, but they had to keep the fire going. Now again, all these things can teach us something. The fire, the ambition, the excitement of being with Yahweh. They had to tend to it. They had to tend to the sacrifices. If you know fires, if you don't clean out the coals, then the air can't move. If the air can't move, the fires go out. It's quite interesting because, of course, his ruach is spoken of as a wind or the air. The Spirit can't move through us and in us and change us. And the fire can start going out on us. They had to take care of that. Tend to the menorah and keep the flame going. Again, they had to tend it. And that menorah would shed light on the commands. And on a daily basis, they had to make sure during the darkest hours, and that was important. And think of it in this regard. When you're going through tribulation, those are the darkest hours, that during the darkest hours, light was still being shown on Yahweh, His mercy, and on His commands. That though it may not seem that Yahweh's with you, caring, leading you at that moment, light is still shining. It is still focused on what He's doing. Make a covering, atonement for the people and for the holy sanctuary. They had to make covering even for the sanctuary to keep the place clean, both physically and spiritually, so that Yahweh could be there. They were tending to it. Priests will teach the difference between clean and unclean. We just read that just a few Torah portions back. They were responsible. And so when we read these chapters, what is clean or unclean, whether sexual conduct, whether it's clean or unclean in what you consume or what you eat, what you live on. What I don't have up there, and I still don't completely understand this concept, it says the priest shall offer up the food of Yahweh. Now I know that Yahweh doesn't need physical food. But something in the reality that the priests were going to give by their obedience a sustenance to Yahweh that He's here with us. I don't know. But it speaks about that. They were to diagnose and treat the unclean and provide a way to make them clean. This is one of the hardest passages in regards to the red heifer. So you go, leper, good, go out of the camp. So you'd go out of the camp. And then you'd have to scream, even if you were near the edge of the camp, unclean, unclean, so other people weren't going to be just made unclean accidentally because you bumped into them. But it wasn't just diagnosing. The red heifer had to be killed. Now, what's intriguing here is this. The priests were not supposedly allowed to become unclean. And yet, by obeying the command here, of killing the red heifer, the one who killed it became unclean until evening. And then the one who cleaned up the ashes became unclean. And then have to move the ashes, leave them at the tabernacle? No, he'd move them to the outskirts of the camp. Why? Because people, because the actual ashes of the heifer was used when a leper or someone unclean was made clean. And you had to sprinkle them with water and the ashes. Well, you know what? If they're not allowed in camp and you're going to keep it at the tabernacle, they're stuck. Can't get in. What I need is in there. No, no. You had to bring it out to them. And by it, what's intriguing, everybody involved became unclean. And yet these ashes were used to make people clean. It's almost like the cleanliness that was in the priest in this action was sucked out of him into those ashes. And those ashes were taken to a place that then that cleanliness could be transferred to someone. Transferred to serve out of love in that regard. Numbers chapter 16. If you'll go there with me. It's not too far from where we left off. 46 to 48. Yahweh's upset with the people. And he has them, he sends a plague. And the plague is killing a huge number of them. Verse 46, and Moses said to Aaron, take a censer, put fire in it from the altar, put incense on it, and take it quickly to the congregation as gone out from Yahweh. The plague has begun. Then Aaron took it as Moses commanded and ran into the midst of the assembly, and already the plague had begun among the people. So he put the incense and made covering for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living. So the plague was stopped. Now it goes into how many died. The focus here is this. His job was to set a line and say, I am standing at this line. And this line is the boundary between death and life. Now we hold this line in the reality of when we teach what is clean and unclean, what is holy and what is common. When we keep His words, we set a boundary and say, this is our boundary that we have set that Yahweh gave us. But as priests, you have to keep it, you have to protect it. And in protecting it, you're actually protecting those, not allowing death to cross that line or them to cross the line into death. Both ways. In between. So we have the priests in between Yahweh and the people, and that's to keep wrath and judgment. And you have him standing in between the living and the dead, so judgment doesn't go any further. Numbers 35, 6. Now among the cities which you will give to the Levites, you shall appoint six cities of refuge to which a manslayer may flee. And to these cities you shall add 42 cities. Numbers 35, 26, and 27. But if the manslayer of any time goes outside the limits of the city of refuge where he has fled, and the avenger of blood finds him outside the limits of his city of refuge, the avenger of blood kills the manslayer, he shall not be guilty of blood. Now, let me explain. The Levites were given cities because they did not get an inheritance like the children did. What's intriguing is because they had cities and they lived in them, if someone were out in the woods with a brother and were doing something and the brother died accidentally, it would provide a refuge, a place to go and hide from family members who may want to execute judgment upon you. So these cities, it was getting interesting, these Levites who are trying to obey the commands, and they have more commands than just the average Israelite. Because they are living it, they actually, again, provide a place of refuge for those people so they're not killed, so the death does not cross over a line. Now that's important. Side note. You realize, if you were Levites, you're all one family. If you were living in one of these cities of refuge, anyone that shows up, that moves into your town, you know. They either murdered someone or they accidentally murdered someone. You can imagine how that community would feel every time a new visitor showed up. Same time, they're Levites. These are the ones, when Moses said for the mountain, who's for God, went and took swords. And they didn't worry about who they killed that was not for Yahweh. Phinehas of Aaron did not worry about who he was going to throw the spear through so God would not bring judgment. So the Levites were not a clan to take lightly. But what's intriguing is because they kept it, it provided a refuge for everybody else. A refuge, by the way, that until the high priest died, the person, and by the way, if you just said an angry word to a brother, this is what Torah says. One angry word to your brother, and someone heard it, and then found out that the two of you were out there, Torah says you must be killed. Which Yeshua elaborates in Matthew to say, if you've said idiot to your brother, you're deserving of death, which elaborates on what the Torah says. Same thing, not a new command, same idea. Genesis 18. Turn with me there. Genesis 18, we're going to be going through the haggling over price that Abraham and Yahweh do over Lot and his family. Now, I do want to give you a sort of an idea of what's going on in Scripture before this. Abraham leaves his country with a wife that cannot have children. Who goes with him? Lot, his nephew. You don't think Abraham's going, well, if I can't have children, I've got him. His father's died. I will take him on, and he'll become my offspring. What's intriguing is Lot, of course, separates. And not until Lot separates, when Lot leaves, then Yahweh gives him the promise that he'll have a son. After the crutch is gone, he depended that Lot might be that inheritance. After that's gone, I'm going to give you a promise. Lot is taken because he decides to go for the fancy land. The land looks really good, at least with the eyes. And that country, Yahweh comes against in regard to judgment, and they drag them away in a war. Abraham finds out about it, takes a few hundred men, which are supposedly trained in battle. Where he got them, I don't know. Who knew Abraham was like some marine? They go off. These just few hundred men go after five different kings, rout them, take everything back and go back. There's no doubt the people from Sodom and Gomorrah are completely ecstatic. Probably why they probably gave Lot one of the best houses in Sodom and Gomorrah. Come live with us. You're like a good luck charm to us. That Abraham will come if something happens. He saved us. Because again, what's interesting is Lot lived on the outskirts, and by the time we see him here, he's living inside the gates. Now what's intriguing is after Abraham saves him, Melchizedek comes, blessed are you for going and save. Yahweh has saved. After this, he again, now he visits and says, you'll have a son at some point in the next year or in some time to come when I come back. Oh, and by the way, I should speak to you about what's going to happen. Now, Abraham has already gone out and saved this boy. He saved them by taking away from his father's house. He saved them in regard to taking them out of the kings that had taken. Yahweh's concerned with him. And so that sort of sets up to where we are, 18:16. This is the men get up to go towards Sodom and Gomorrah. And the men rose and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them and sent them on the way. And Yahweh said, "Shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. For I have known him, in order they may command his children and his household after him. They keep the way of Yahweh, to do righteousness and justice, that Yahweh may bring to Abraham what he has spoken." And Yahweh said, "Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it." Basically, I've heard it's bad. I'm going to go see for myself. Is it that bad? Verse 22. And the men turned from there and went towards Sodom. For Abraham stood still before Yahweh. And Abraham came near and said, "Would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" Now he's been told Sodom could be bad. And so his concern is over Lot. We destroy the righteous with the wicked? Because Yahweh could, right? He has that right, Dainu. It would have been enough. "Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you destroy the place and not spare it for 50 righteous? If they were in it?" So his first number of the haggling is 50 people. Now, whenever you haggle for something, you start for a higher price and you're trying to head towards some middle price. 50 people? Yahweh's answer is, verse 25, "Far be it for you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so the righteous should be as wicked. Far be it from you, shall you not judge? Aren't you the judge of all the earth, and you're going to do the right thing?" Again, this is someone who's emotional, because this is his nephew. "Aren't you Yahweh?" It's basically what he's saying. So Yahweh said, "If I find in Sodom 50 righteous in this city, then I will spare the place for their sakes. I will not bring judgment if there are 50 righteous people in this city." Abraham answered and said, "Indeed now, I am but dust." And he might have realized he went a little too far with his first words. "I am but dust." Now, that's interesting because, of course, this would go back to Genesis, from dust to dust and ashes, and have taken it upon myself to speak to Yahweh. "Suppose there was 5 less than 50 righteous." Now, notice there's a wording here that's important. "Would you destroy the city for a lack of 5? Now, the haggle here is for a lack of 5. So what he's really saying here is, for 5 people, would you destroy the city? Now, what it sounds like is 45, but what Abraham is trying to do is take from 50 all the way down to 5. For a lack of 5? Come on! Now, we'll get to in a second why he chose 5. Yahweh answers him back, not saying the 5, by the way. He said, "If I find 45, I will not destroy it." He knows the rules of the game and loopholes and wording of contracts. And he spoke to him again, and suppose there should be 40 found there. And he continues, 40, 30, 20, 10. All the way down to 10. Verse 32. Then he said, "Let not the Lord be angry that I speak once more. Suppose 10 should be found there." And he said, "I will not destroy it for the sake of 10. So Yahweh went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. So notice he gives the same thing. As long as there are 10, I will not destroy it. 10 righteous people. What does righteous mean? obeying the commands. Or at least having faith that whatever Yahweh spoke is going to happen. We see that with Abraham. Now, again, Yahweh will not destroy for the sake of 10. Now, Lot, his family is 4 going on 6. Where do I get that? Well, there's Lot and his wife, his 2 daughters, and when we come to them, they're engaged to 2 husbands. So it's 4 going on 6. So you can get the feeling Abraham's maybe going, 4, maybe 1's already married, because he has already talked to him before now, because he went to rescue him. Maybe there's 5, 6. Maybe he remembers Noah. And Noah, it was Noah, his wife, 3 sons, and 3 wives of the sons. That makes 8 people. For 8 people, while Yahweh judged the world, he saved that family. Do we think that Abraham may have known about Noah? I think so. I think when he said we're only dust, I think he was quoting in regard to the reality of Genesis. In regard to from dust to dust. I think he knew about Noah. In fact, many people will point out the times that Noah was probably alive when Abraham was. Looking back at our camp. Numbers 1, 47 to 53 said we were responsible over the tabernacle of the testimony, responsible for the articles of the tabernacle, need to carry the tabernacle and the articles, attend to the tabernacle and camp around it, so that no wrath would come on Israel. Now, here's my point. Yahweh set up the Levites to be around him. And he gave the Levites more laws than apply to us. Every day, so many sacrifices. Blood to put here, blood to put there. Put the water, change your clothes. Put the ashes out here, put the ashes out there. What did he do? He created simple commands. Go and do all these simple commands. And by doing so, I will see what? Obedience. And because I see obedience all around me, I'll be able to be with you. I'll be able to stay with you. I'll be able to be your God and you be my people. It's sort of like putting up a veil. The Levites became a veil. So Yahweh could say, I'm going to focus just on the Levites and how they're serving me. Because if I were to focus on the outskirts for that unclean person who just got put out of the camp because I had to give him leprosy, they might all have to be judged right now because I am with them. Notice when he comes to Sodom and Gomorrah and he shows up. So you have this theory. I have a theory that when Yahweh judges, it's not specifically sitting here going, sorry, the total doesn't work out. Sorry. You're 1 point away, though. What I think in regard to judgment is that Yahweh shows up. And when Yahweh shows up with the full reality of who he is, and you're against him, you're done. Because he knows the heart. He doesn't have to sit here and worry about someone telling him or what he sees. He knows the heart. His word is in your heart or it's not. And think of that heart sort of like a flame retardant. You've been injected with something that when the flames come on you, you don't burn up. Like the bush, like the mountain. But those who don't have it, ash. Gone. Like Nadab and Abihu, gone. Now they weren't ash specifically, but gone that fast. Very quickly. Here's my point. our lives in service to Yahweh, to His Word, create a sanctuary in the place we live for Yahweh to be here, to be with us. And if He's with us, then Yahweh can use us to reach out and touch other lives, to serve other people. You see, they became the guards, not only His Word, but of His people themselves, and trying to protect them from falling away, protect them from the wrath of Yahweh. By how they taught, by what they taught, and by the example that they shared. See, our obedience is needed to create the place where Yahweh lives. Without it, He can't be here. Can't be in our lives, can't be here, no one can feel. Can't reach out. Our responsibility. We need to provide a place for Yahweh to be among His children. And that's the reality of loving Yahweh. You shall love Him with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. That provides a place. You need to provide a place for others to meet with Yahweh. Because Yahweh is in your life, that means now Yahweh lives on your block, in your neighborhood. That provides, guess what? Your neighbor to see Yahweh. How is He going to do that? By you loving your neighbor. You see, it's almost like as servants, we become the chain link between the world and Yahweh. But without us, there's no connection between the world and Yahweh. So it's almost like we're becoming, like Yeshua, the way to the Father. Are we perfect ways to the Father? Absolutely not. We're not. But notice, even in Sodom and Gomorrah, if there were 10 righteous people there, so I could dwell there, He would not bring judgment. Wrath. He would give mercy. We're to care for, keep, protect His Word and covenant. That's in our life. Meaning we've got to look at our life going, oh, am I moving too far one way? Am I moving too far one another way? Am I going fast enough? Am I going slow enough? There's always a process. Who am I following today? Because it's a daily choice. And we've got to be careful. What's most incredible to me is that He's asking us to disciple others to cross over and minister. Let me just quickly go back here. As I close, I just want to bring up the point of the different groups. If you would have leprosy or be completely unclean, you'd be on the outskirts. By the way, this is where there would be gnashing of teeth and darkness, because in the middle would be a pillar of fire at night. So it would provide protection, because you see, when enemy forces saw the fire, this is why, by the way, we have lights on the outside of our houses. Light comes on, person runs away, right? They can't sneak up on us. Animals see a fire, don't want to go near it. The pillar of fire would come up, but the further from the tabernacle, the darker it became. So you got to the outer darkness, which is where you'd be put if you were completely unclean. Then you'd be brought into the camp as one of the people. You might even move up to the reality of being a chief. But the point is, then there were people who would have to serve the priesthood. That was the Levites. Cleaning up, caring for things. It was all about serving with the heart. And in so, you would cross over and be connection between the people and God. You would go into the kingdom, come back. Go into the kingdom, come back. Go in, keeping it to be the whole kingdom and keeping care of the kingdom. You were the person that would go back and forth, a messenger. Just like the angels going up that stairwell, same idea. You are messengers going up and down that stairwell. What are you carrying? His word. So, our job, our responsibility, we're reading Leviticus or Numbers, and we're getting into, oh, it's blood again. We're killing animals. Oh, so much detail. I promise you, you were called out to be a nation of priests, to serve and to love. And Ariel will only stay Ariel if we create that place that Yahweh can be here. And what can be done with merciful, loving hearts who are hungry for the truth? It's the only way. Who are hungry to open the door and say, I've made that journey from the outside in. Let me show you where the pitfalls are, where I made mistakes, so I can show you how to get in here with less of a problem. That's our life. That's our work. That's our responsibility. Thankfully, even Yahweh as our Father does what every day? Teaches us how to do it better and better every day. But we have to go to Him, willing to listen, open hearts, ready to change. Baruch Hashem. Yevarecha Yahweh v'yishmerecha. Ki Yahweh bendiga et teputeha. May Yahweh bless you and keep you. Yisi Yahweh, Yar Yahweh panavidecha vihunecha. Ki Yahweh agasu rosho espendeser sobriti ite otoge sabandad. May Yahweh make His face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. Yisi Yahweh panavidecha yisem lecha shalom. Ki Yahweh muestre su rosho espendeser sobre ti ite conceda su paz. May Yahweh turn His face towards you and give you His perfect peace. Shabbat shalom.